Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Good afternoon. It's the show on 91.5. Along with Mark Brody, I'm Steve Goldstein.
In Valley traffic, 101 southbound in the West Valley, a crash at Indian School has the HOV lane blocked. And on the 17 northbound, a crash at Northern. Sunny skies for the rest of the afternoon with a high of 105. 103 is average for today. Clear skies tonight, overnight lows near 80. Slight chance of afternoon rain tomorrow with a high of 100. It's 97 degrees right now.
Wildfire season in Arizona has begun in earnest. The Tenderfoot Fire, close to where a destructive blaze killed 19 firefighters in 2013 near Yarnell, has been burning since Wednesday. KJZZ's Stina Sieg is covering the fire. And Stina, where are you right now?
So I'm right next to the Incident Control Center, which is actually the elementary school in Peoples Valley, which is just a little bit north of Yarnell, and it's a little bit north of the fire. And right next to us is a pond in the front of somebody's ranch. It's being used for water drops by the helicopters here.
Now, late yesterday, news was not good. Can you give us the latest news on the fire?
So there's a new estimate that we've burned more than 1,100 acres. Last night, it was only estimated between 600 and 700 acres. But you know, the fire officials here are kind of cautioning people not to be alarmed by that difference because it was just an estimate yesterday. And this morning, they actually did a flyover with a GPS to do a better estimate. Right now, it's got 220 crews working on the fire, and it is 10% contained. And today, I actually spoke with a forestry spokesman, Mike Reichling, and he explained, why there was such a difference in the estimation of the acreage.
It is just based on an eyeball looking across the, mountain range and say, well, it looks like it could be 600 to 700 until you get up in the air and you actually fly it with a GPS around the circumference of it to get an accurate number. So
Stina, yesterday an evacuation order was put out, but not everyone left. What explains that?
So I think in the beginning it was really just stubbornness from some people. I spoke to some folks who couldn't get back into town and they were really upset because like their parents were there or their siblings were there and just refused to leave. And that was mostly on the west side of town. But as the day wore on, it became clear that staying on the west side of town was actually a lot safer than had been originally thought. Mike Reichling explains why.
Operations yesterday afternoon was able to get the fire burned back up the mountain and go away from the home. So a lot of the people who were planned to be evacuated from the west side of the original fire from 3 years ago were able to stay without the threat of being burned with the fire heading in the opposite direction.
Now, Stina, 3 years ago, there was an incomparably emotional situation with the town of Yarnell, with the 19 hotshots dying in that fire. In general, how is the town of Yarnell doing now?
Well, last night, it was pretty emotional from some people out, south of town that were not able to get back into their homes. And now that I'm on the north side of town, things seem pretty calm. The electricity is back on. They've brought in a temporary cell tower. People seem pretty optimistic. And I think more than anything, people just want the road to open up and they want to go back home.
KJZZ's Stina Sieg covering the Tenderfoot Fire near Yarnell. Stina, thanks very much.
Thank you so much.
Fire officials are concerned about wildfires breaking out in other parts of the state as well, and they'll be implementing more fire restrictions as Arizona's fire season continues. As KJZZ's Kerry Young reports, this comes as crews monitor more than 20 active wildfires in the state.
The Tonto National Forest imposed fire restrictions on Wednesday, banning fires within its boundaries in northern Arizona, with the exception of a few developed campgrounds. Officials with Prescott National Forest say they'll be moving to Stage 1 fire restrictions sometime next week. Spokeswoman Adrian Reagan says that also prohibits campfires outside of developed campgrounds and limits where people can smoke or use firearms.
This time of year in June, in summertime, is when we do expect if there's going to be wildfires break out, it'll be happening.
The restrictions come as firefighters work to control the Tenderfoot Fire near Yarnell. Kerry Young, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Business owners in Yuma are worried about a proposal that could put a huge dent in the community's lemon business. The U.S. Department of Agriculture's Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service, or APHIS, says the new rule would modify regulations to allow lemons from Argentina into the U.S. Rocky Curtis, who's president of Yuma's Mission Citrus, is alarmed by the potential impact Argentina's lemons could have on the area's economy, and more specifically, his company. Rocky, were you blindsided by this?
Yeah, I was very blindsided. You know, in Arizona and California, citrus farmers are facing numerous number of pest diseases already, and with Argentina shipping in the U.S., pose for even more plant and health risks. You know, it just could be disastrous to U.S. farmers. They've got, you know, citrus black spot disease, which is a very bad disease. We just feel that the federal plant and health experts should review these pests and disease risk in Argentina before they commit to this final decision granting access to the U.S.
So you're saying that the potential of bringing in something from Argentina could complicate things even more. It's not just a competition situation. It's an actual idea of, are they going to bring in this disease that we don't have here yet and cause more problems?
Well, Argentina is a big player. You know, they ship 90 million cartons where the United States ships 40. And it's just, you know, Mission Citrus has 100 growers throughout the state of Arizona, and they employ thousands of people. And this would really, really hurt our local community. We've been harvesting and packing lemons by hand. We do especially in the field, we've been doing the same thing for a couple hundred years. And with the government raising minimum wage at all time, we have no problem with that. We would like our people to have a better, you know, way of life. But at the same time, when we have to compete with Argentina, who has a minimum wage of $2 an hour, it's just going to put us out of business, and which is sad, because between this farming industry and the citrus industry in Arizona and California, it's been passed through generations of families, and it's just going to make it really tough to compete.
Well, so what do you think's going on here? What made this happen?
You know, I'm not real sure, but I know that Obama made a trip to Argentina months ago, and it's all about getting pharmaceuticals into Argentina. And one of the things the president of Argentina wanted was open access to citrus into the United States. And, you know, I think that's got a lot to do with it.
It seems to me that since you have been doing this for such a long time, and you've got a system that works, you've got a product that people like, is it a situation where it's just quality is not going to matter quite as much? Because it seems from a standpoint of quality, you're going to be able to compete with Argentina. But are you saying that because of the fact they produce so much and their wages are so low, that the competition's just simply not going to be on a level playing field?
That's correct. You know, Argentina, they put a half million cartons on a ship into Philadelphia, New York. They can get fruit there cheaper, and I can put it on a truck here in Yuma or Phoenix and get it into Philly.
Have you or people who work for you talked with members of Congress, Arizona's delegation, anything to kind of fight this?
We're talking with Congress all the time, and California has put together a group of farmers and has got a lot of support and has already made a couple trips to Washington. We're now approaching our Arizona congressman and trying to feel him out to feel what's his take on this.
So you're not giving up yet? Not a total lost cause for you?
No, we're not giving up. We'll fight it.
Rocky Curtis, president of Mission Citrus in Yuma. In an email exchange, the U.S. Department of Agriculture told us, quote, "The decision to import is based solely on science and whether the commodity has any pest risks that threaten American agriculture." And in June 2015, APHIS officials visited Argentina to verify that mitigation measures adequately address U.S. quarantine concerns. The geographic location is based on the area in Argentina from where lemons may be imported safely into the U.S., end quote. The proposed rule on lemon importation is open for public comment until July 11th.
The Maricopa Association of Governments, or MAG, is set to vote later this month on the transportation projects to fund over the next several years. MAG's regional council finished taking public input this week. Joining me with what may be in that final plan is Eric Anderson, MAG's transportation director. And Eric, what kinds of projects does MAG think are priorities right now?
Obviously, on the highway side, one of our big projects is the South Mountain Freeway, which we hope to have ADOT will have that under construction this summer. There is some litigation pending, but hopefully that'll get resolved here this summer. On the transit side, and that's where a lot of activity is, with the City of Phoenix passage of their increased sales tax last year, Phoenix has been able to accelerate some projects. I think the one that I think we're going to see happen fairly quickly is extension of light rail down Central Avenue to Baseline Road.
How much money are you able to allocate for all of these projects that MAG wants to do?
Well, over the next 5 years, our Transportation Improvement Program, which includes all regionally significant projects, totals about $5 billion in projects. And that's broken down between transit projects and highway projects, as well as a number of bike and pedestrian multi-use path-type facilities around the valley, as well as a lot of street projects that are some are regionally funded, some are funded by the cities themselves.
If you were sort of king of the world, I mean, how much money do you think it would take to do all of the projects that MAG would ideally like to do?
Well, that's a good question, and we have a number of projects that we have queued up in our plan waiting for available funding, and so obviously one of the long-range projects that has really statewide significance is Interstate 11, which has been talked about now for a number of years, and another project that we're trying to find some additional funding for is what we call State Route 30, or the I-10 Reliever, which is a freeway that basically parallels Interstate 10 in the West Valley, but is about 4 or 5 miles south of I-10. And if you travel in the West Valley at pretty much any time of the day, Interstate 10 is really highly congested. And so having a parallel freeway to provide some alternative access is extremely important. So, you know, we're about $1.5 billion short on that one. And so we will continue to look at resources. Some of these projects we think may be part of a package that may go to the voters at some point in the future as a renewal of our half-cent sales tax in Maricopa County.
Is the state of Valley Freeways good enough that you're really able to focus on newer projects like that Route 30 and the South Mountain Freeway and potentially I-11?
Yeah, pretty much. What we see happening now, for example, the Loop 101 that's under construction, or the improvements are under construction across the Salt River Indian Community, that'll result in 4 general purpose lanes and an HOV lane in each direction. And that freeway then will be finished, basically. We don't have any plans to widen it beyond that. So there's some projects like that we have to continue to do, as well as some new freeways, because we expect the Phoenix area to continue to grow and add population. But I think the next round of funding, regional funding, I think there'll be a major emphasis on maintenance and repair. For example, the stack interchange at I-17 and I-10, it was built in 1990, and so by 2030, that structure will be 40 years old, and it'll probably need to have some rehab done to it. So, you know, those are the kinds of things where we really are going to be shifting our focus from adding new capacity on the highway side, although there will still be some, but maintaining what we have, I think, is going to be a big part of that.
Eric Anderson is the Transportation Director for the Maricopa Association of Governments. Eric, thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
It's the show on 91.5. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And along with the Takeaways' Todd Zwillick today, I'm Mark Brody. Presumptive Democratic nominee Hillary Clinton earned the presumptive part of that title the day before Tuesday's primaries, on a day when no voters went to the polls and no votes were cast. Instead, the Associated Press's call was based on interviews with superdelegates who pledged to support Hillary Clinton but don't actually vote until the convention in July.
And who, Bernie Sanders reminds us, could be persuaded to change their minds between now and then. Stephen Olmacher from the AP led the vote count. Here's his response on Fox News.
When you know something, you know, this is news. You know, we've been counting delegates in primaries and caucuses. We've been calling superdelegates and reporting on what they tell us. And when we got to 2383, that's news. The fact that a candidate for the Democratic nomination has the support of enough delegates to win the nomination at the convention, that's news, and reporting the news is what we do.
Joining me now to discuss the AP's decision is Jerry Hester. He's director of reporting and writing at the CUNY Graduate School of Journalism here in New York. Jerry, welcome.
Thanks, Todd.
Well, what do you make of the timing and the process that the AP used here?
Well, look, this is something that clearly, for a lot of reasons, the Clinton camp didn't like. A lot of voters may have not liked. And the Sanders camp certainly hated. But the AP, in the end, did its job. It reported its news, and it did it in a proactive way. You know, in terms of the timing, it wasn't as much as before the six primaries this past Tuesday, but after the primary in Puerto Rico. That's when the numbers really told the story.
But here's the big problem, though, is that the AP surveys superdelegates. They have the count of pledged delegates, and they say, based on our conversations with who the superdelegates are going to support, she has enough people for the nomination. The question is, who are they to say that? Bernie Sanders is correct. They could potentially, as unlikely as it is, go to every superdelegate and convince them to change their minds. It may be a long shot, but if it's possible under the rules, who's the AP to say that she's got the nomination?
I mean, that's absolutely true. But AP is reporting a moment in time. And the key word, and the one they keep using, is presumptive. You know, you can imagine if AP would have come out and that their reporting would have shown that delegates were thinking about turning to Bernie, that would have been an incredible story as well. And that would have been one that they should have broken the moment they were confident of being able to say that.
So we don't report results like this or exit polls like this until polls close. There have been lessons learned on election nights that you don't do that reporting until everybody has gotten a chance to vote. They even withhold results because of time zones, right? So that California voters or Oregon voters don't get turned off and stay home. It seems like this may have had a similar effect, though.
You know, I would I'd say there's a difference here when you're dealing with, you know, calling an election based on early returns and or exit polls. You're making an extrapolation. And, you know, certainly as we learned in 2000, there's a time zone issue, as you point out. But I think this is a different kind of exercise. This was reporting. This was the AP going out and talking to 700 odd people. It's, I think, a lot different than kind of a mathematical exercise where you're extrapolating from numbers. And again, the reporting what it is in time now. Could that change? Possibly. Could this potentially have an effect on whether that changes or not? Absolutely. But it's not the AP's job to protect us democracy from itself. It's AP's job to report the facts as they are.
Did the AP do a good enough job of making all of those stipulations that you and I have been making? That yes, superdelegates are free to change their minds. Yes, they could. This is a moment in time, but right now we're saying this. It could change if Bernie Sanders hits a home run.
Yeah, I think in the way that they framed it in terms of calling her the presumptive nominee, in terms of any kind of speculation in their own main story, there wasn't much. But their story certainly has spurred that conversation and more.
And of course, once that story gets onto cable news in particular and conversations like this, it's not covered in the nuanced way. The Chyron says AP colon Hillary Clinton presumptive nominee. That matters.
Absolutely. The headlines matter. And as you can see, this story from the AP made headlines. It was a banner headline across the top of the New York Times, both on the physical paper and on their homepage and in the mobile feed. And in all of those, in big letters, you had AP says.
What about the accusation from the Sanders campaign that if not a conspiracy, this was an establishment nudge towards Hillary Clinton from the AP, from the corporate media that was designed to put his candidacy to bed finally?
I can't say what goes on in terms of the decision-making at the AP and what spurs them. But from their public accounts, from the way that the story has been presented, and seemingly from the solid reporting behind it, they're telling the news.
And we should also be clear about Bernie Sanders in this conversation, too. This is an experienced politician who knows the rules, not only in the Democratic Party, but in the media and how the game is played. And he understands if a news organization is going to make a call, that he can play it a certain way to make it seem like they're all against him. That plays to his campaign narrative.
Well, yeah, in terms of his narrative, it's not him losing New Jersey necessarily. It's not him losing California. It's turning on this idea of the superdelegates. And remember, the superdelegates are something that he has not necessarily been in favor before, but now they've become his last and perhaps only hope.
competing incentives in a fast-moving campaign, the AP's timing, and their judgment in reporting that Hillary Rodham Clinton was the presumptive nominee before everyone went to the polls in New Jersey and California and everywhere else on Tuesday. Jerry Hester, Director of Reporting and Writing at the CUNY Graduate School for Journalism. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Todd.
That's the Takeaways. Todd Zwillick.
In the last 2 years, more than 10,000 Central American child migrants have faced deportation proceedings without ever finding a lawyer to help them. From KJZ's Fronteras desk, Jude Joffe Block reports thousands more children face the same fate despite government efforts to fund more free lawyers.
A new law client is arriving at the Office of Public Counsel, a Los Angeles legal services organization, for the very first time. The client is a 14-year-old girl from Guatemala who only speaks Spanish. She allowed us to sit in as long as we don't use her name. She wears Converse sneakers with her school uniform. Her dark hair is piled in a top knot, and occasionally she flashes a shy smile. She's here because she's one of the more than 60,000 unaccompanied children put in deportation proceedings after being caught at the border in the last 2 years. And up until now, she was on track to be among the 40% of those kids who never find a lawyer to represent them. The legal assistant asked the young girl, who's in middle school, if she knows the immigration court process. She nods.
The procedure is we have to show up to court. We can't miss it. And come with a lawyer to explain why we left our countries.
She says a relative in Guatemala was abusing her, so her family hired a smuggler so she could join her mother in L.A. She could be eligible for asylum or a special legal status for foreign kids who were abused or abandoned. But winning those cases is complex. After she showed up in court 3 times without a lawyer, the immigration judge told her she had to find one to come to her next hearing in the fall.
He said it's September. I have to come to court with a lawyer. Otherwise, my mom will have to represent me.
But her mother, who works as a nanny, doesn't know immigration law or speak much English. They couldn't afford to pay the thousands of dollars lawyers charge for these cases.
Nerviosa.
I felt nervous and scared because we hadn't found anyone who would help us.
The free legal service providers were all booked. Finally, after months of waiting, she made it off a long wait list to be represented by public counsel at no cost. It's one of the legal service organizations getting federal funds to do this work. Bobby Gregg of the Federal Office of Refugee Resettlement says there's a federal statute that requires her agency
to provide representation to children. To the extent practicable, I think is the word used, yes. To the extent practicable.
In the past, that meant giving kids a legal orientation and sometimes putting them in touch with volunteer lawyers. But 2 years ago, when the number of child migrants surged, the agency began a pilot to pay for direct legal services for a small portion of the kids. More recently,
we were able to, within the budget, build a direct representation program that would serve more children, but certainly not all of the children.
The $54 million program includes paying for lawyers for 8,000 kids this year. A few thousand more will be helped by other government initiatives. But more than 30,000 Central American kids have arrived since October. Judy London of Public Counsel, where the Guatemalan teenager is getting help, says it's still a lottery which kids get lawyers at no cost and which don't.
The problem is that every child deserves to have a fair immigration court proceeding, and that cannot happen without a lawyer.
Many of these cases are time sensitive, since the window for some legal arguments, like child abandonment, can expire when a child turns 18. Immigration court data show the majority of kids without lawyers wind up skipping court and are ordered deported.
Until every child is guaranteed legal representation, there will not be fairness, and essentially children will remain at extreme risk.
In fact, that's the argument a federal lawsuit in Seattle is making. Stephen Kang of the American Civil Liberties Union is suing the federal government on behalf of child migrants.
The core claim in our case is that you cannot, consistent with the Constitution, put children in immigration court where they have to face off against trained government prosecutors without also providing the children lawyers of their own.
The government has argued there's no legal obligation to provide these children lawyers at taxpayer expense, but a judge recently denied the government's efforts to dismiss the case, and a trial is set for September. Jude Joffe Block, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
You're listening to the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
My name is Honey Danger of Honey Danger and the I-10 Shooters. We're at Law & Gnome Publishing for the Pink Slip open mic.
It's kind of hard to explain the love we have.
You find people who come up on stage and sing and play their instruments. Sometimes you find stand-ups. You find people who do slam poetry.
So I'm finished with school this semester. Yeah, I'm not graduating or anything. I'm just finished going.
My friend Jonathan, who's in my band, he actually came here just to check it out.
Yeah. We're gonna go for it. You ready?
And now he performs and he participates, and now we're in a band together. It's a good place to meet people. It's a good place to go to if you're nervous about performing an open mic, because everyone here is so supportive.
There's that, you know.
That's Honey Danger singing at Pink Slip open mic at Law & Gnome Bookstore in Phoenix. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix, or would just like us to close our mics, send us a note, theshow@kjzz.org.
In KJZZ News at 2:36, two construction workers were injured in surprise this morning at the overpass worksite on Grand Avenue. From KJZZ's West Valley Bureau, Casey Kuhn reports one of those men is in critical condition.
The worker was airlifted to a trauma center after suffering injuries from a 40-foot fall. The Surprise Fire Department says this happened after a large concrete girder collapsed on the construction site. Workers have been building the Arizona Department of Transportation overpass project at Grand Avenue and Bell Road for about 2 months. Officials say the other man escaped with minor injuries and was taken to a hospital. ADOT is still investigating the cause of the collapse. Casey Kuhn, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Arizona's 5th District Congressman Matt Salmon is already set for his next career when his current term expires in January. He's going to become ASU's Vice President for Government Affairs. In a statement, school president Michael Crow said, quote, "Our relationships with lawmakers and education policymakers will be greatly strengthened with Matt on our team." So how unique is this kind of effort to give a university a chance to get more connected on Capitol Hill? To talk about that, I'm joined by Scott Jasek, editor of Inside Higher Ed. Scott, are we seeing more of this sort of thing from these large research universities?
The reality is, while people think of them as getting support from the state, that's certainly not totally true these days in Arizona. And they depend heavily on federal agencies for research support, which in turn involves not just research projects, but graduate student support. Policies about student aid affect undergraduates who are receiving aid or loans. The financing of a big, complicated research university, of which Arizona State is one, very much caught up in what's going on in Washington.
So, Scott, is this something that we have seen at other large research universities before, but maybe not quite as obvious as actually hiring a congressperson?
You see it. Lots of universities have offices here and have full-time people here who are lobbying and working with agencies. They're not necessarily all former members of Congress, but they're people who know the lobbying scene here and know the universities that they're representing. So this is not surprising. There are a bunch of places that, in fact, have lobbyists. It's, I don't want to say a majority, but for research universities like Arizona State, this is quite common.
Are we seeing any trends then, Scott, in higher education that would make it so it's even more vital these days? You mentioned a lack of funding coming from many states, but are there certain trends in higher ed that it's really especially important that these research universities have the ears of lawmakers?
Well, it's not just the ears of lawmakers. It's also the ears of agencies. Again, I don't know what the Arizona State job focus will be, but the Washington lobbying offices don't just work on Congress. A place like Arizona State cares deeply about decisions to take place at the National Institutes of Health, at the National Science Foundation, at the Energy Department, at lots of agencies. And it's not like they can go in and say, please give us a grant. But they want to inform those people of areas of research interest. They want to work on the conditions and regulations that are associated with various grants and programs. So it's not just things that show up in legislation. It's the whole scene here.
And how much of this has to do with letting agencies, letting lawmakers know about some of the good works that some of these universities are doing? How much of it is about maybe twisting some arms a little bit?
There are limits on the arm twisting, because if you look at the big grants that most universities are most proud of, they came through the peer review process. So it's not like the head of the NSF is sitting around and thinking, oh, the Arizona State lobbyist ran into me at an event yesterday. It's a bunch of scientists reviewing proposals that include an Arizona State proposal. But what the agencies are deciding more of is, how do we shape this grant competition? What are the regulations about the use of the federal money in this area? Issues like that. And if certain programs are shaped in the right direction, that can help a university win grants. Now, before money got tight in Washington, a lot of universities pushed hard for earmarks, which is a direct grant, and some still pull those off from time to time, but that's not as dominant as it once was, because there's so many limits on federal spending.
What could a university think it's going to gain by having sort of an ultimate insider doing these things rather than just an experienced lobbyist, someone who's actually just coming out the door as having just been in Congress? Do they expect maybe that person has even more idea of what's going on right now, what some of the major priorities are? What do you make of that specifically?
Not knowing the specifics of Arizona State's goals, but generally such a person does know what's going on, is able to open doors that maybe others can't. A vice president for government relations isn't on a peer review committee awarding grants, but probably knows a lot of people in town who are deciding on priorities, who are thinking about even the overall budget for the NIH-NSF. That matters to Arizona State.
Scott Jasik is editor of Inside Higher Ed.
A federal judge in California is weighing a proposed settlement in a lawsuit filed by Uber drivers against the ride-sharing startup. A recent hearing produced spirited debate over the $84 million agreement. Marisa Kendall is a tech reporter for the San Jose Mercury News and was at that hearing. Marisa, first off, what's the lawsuit all about and what's in this settlement?
The lawsuit came about when some drivers who work for Uber sued over Uber's classification of them as independent contractors. They're saying they should actually be classified as employees and should therefore get employee benefits such as overtime pay and compensation for expenses they incurred while driving. The settlement, which is starts out as $84 million that Uber would pay out, but if Uber has a successful IPO or is sold and certain conditions are met, that would jump to $100 million. Uber is not forced to reclassify the drivers as employees, but the Uber drivers would get payouts depending on how long they had driven for Uber. If they were full-time drivers for a number of months, the lawyer representing the drivers has said they could get up to an average of $8,000. Whereas if they'd only driven for a few hours, for a couple of days, they could get maybe $25.
Would this cover Uber drivers nationwide?
This is for California and Massachusetts drivers.
And there are sort of parallel lawsuits for drivers in other places, is that right?
Yes, and that is causing some problems with this settlement. A bunch of lawyers and drivers have jumped in and sued for this same thing. And the settlement actually would release some of those claims in California. So lawyers who are bringing parallel lawsuits in California are now upset, and they went into court and were challenging the settlement agreement last week, which possibly could be problematic for them.
Is the concern that drivers would get a one-time payment instead of a permanent reclassification and all the other benefits that go along with that?
Yeah, that's part of the concern. Some drivers are saying, you know, that the payout isn't enough. You know, the lawyer representing these drivers has been accused of selling out the case by, you know, she's taking a large chunk of attorney fees. And yeah, there's no permanent reclassification. So this issue is not solved. You know, there's going to be more lawsuits that are going to bring the same thing in other states. And these drivers are still going to think that they should be entitled to these employee benefits.
Do the drivers that this settlement would cover seem satisfied with the deal?
It's hard to tell. It really depends. There's been several dozen formal objections by drivers filed with the court. One telling sign is the named plaintiff, Mr. Douglas O'Connor himself, whose name is on the lawsuit and all of the filings, actually withdrew his support from the settlement and cut ties with his lawyer. He hired a new lawyer, and now he's fighting against that settlement.
And Uber is not the only startup that is facing this kind of issue, right? There's a similar lawsuit that Lyft is dealing with.
Yes, and Lyft settled that lawsuit recently. That was for $27 million, and they are also facing some concerns over that settlement. There's been a little bit of controversy over whether that should go through as well, so we're also still waiting on a decision there.
Marisa Kendall is tech reporter for the San Jose Mercury News. Marisa, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Cities across the valley are looking inward these days, refocusing resources and money on creating attractive downtowns. Now, downtown Mesa is hoping a deal with ASU will jumpstart their downtown's growth. Voters will have their chance to approve the potentially $160 million project to build a new ASU campus in downtown Mesa this fall. And if it passes, city officials there hope it'll bring some new energy to its sleepy Center City.
Mesa's got a kind of a reputation that we roll up the carpet at 5 o'clock and everything shuts down. It's not true, but I would like for that perception to be gone in 10 years.
Jeff McVeigh is with the city of Mesa, and the show's Lauren Gilger met him in downtown Mesa to talk about all of this. And Lauren, the ASU campus is just part of some larger plans Mesa has for its downtowns, is that right?
That's right. In fact, Jeff McVeigh, who I met down there, actually has the title Manager of Downtown Transformation for the city. He says the city's been focused on its downtown for quite some time, and then when Mayor John Giles took office last year, downtown revitalization was a major focus for him. So he says they really have a lot of great things in downtown Mesa already that import people to their venues for events and things like that. Now they just need to refocus on the residential front, getting people to actually live there and activating their culture, the restaurant scene, and nightlife there.
Our downtown, we have, and this will be my short list, we have our Mesa Art Center. It's the largest art center in the Southwest. That brings in almost 500,000 people a year. We have the Arizona Museum of Natural History. We have the IDEA Museum, which used to be the Museum for Youth. We have the Mesa Arizona Temple, the first temple built outside of Salt Lake City. And that's, you know, the name of a few. We add in the amphitheater, we have a convention center. We have a great number of very successful features in downtown. What we're hopeful is that by building an ASU campus with a park that is tying it all together, that will be the connector to all these other successful amenities that are down here.
So what does this potential plan with ASU look like exactly?
Depending on what voters approve, they're talking about building four buildings near the existing Mesa City Plaza, as well as a five-acre park as part of this new campus. They'll house digital and sensory technologies, performance and media arts, early childhood development, and entrepreneurial support programs, and it could all bring up to 3,500 students there. So McVeigh showed me around the area where they're planning all of this, and it's right on the light rail and near their historic downtown retail area. So he has high hopes for what bringing that many students to that area could do for downtown Mesa.
Right now we are at the Mesa City Plaza. We're at the intersection of Center and Main Street. We were actually looking at a light rail train at our Center Street station, right across from the Mesa Art Center. Most of the comments I get from my coworkers are that we're going to be taking away all of our parking. So all the parking we're walking up next to will become either an open space, a civic plaza, or it'll become something related to ASU facilities.
Is the light rail sort of part of the motivation for ASU to come down here?
Completely related to light rail. Unlike downtown Phoenix, where they were able to bring entire schools and put them into a downtown campus, they don't have the ability to lift a new school or create a new school and bring it here. So we'll be getting, you know, full programs of a school, but the connection to Tempe and downtown Phoenix is important, and light rail is that connection.
We are the poster child for urban sprawl in the valley, and that seems to be really changing right now. Why do you think that is?
The demographics are changing. The people that desired the sprawl type development, they are in the minority now. Baby boomers are aging. They want to have the same amenities that the millennials want. And those amenities are oftentimes in more urban settings.
So as kind of we watch this happen all over the valley, and you said this has been a focus for downtown Mesa for a long time. Why is it important to Mesa, to the city council here, to the government here, that you invest in this downtown?
We know that today people choose their place where they want to live before they choose their job. And in order to compete in that marketplace, we need to provide a downtown that it has those amenities and features that they want in their community. For many years, Mesa was the fastest growing community in the nation in the 80s and 90s. We're still growing fairly fast, and at nearly 500,000 people now, we need a downtown that is reflective of a city that size.
So this is your job, like this is all you do, right?
Yeah.
Is try and envision the future for downtown Mesa. So what do you hope in 10 years this looks like?
I hope in 10 years that if you came back down here to talk to me again, that you would be able to, without any work, visibly point out where it's changed. That instead of us standing here and being able to count the number of cars that go by, that we're standing here trying to get out of the way of all the people. That's what I envision in 10 years.
That's Mesa's manager of downtown transformation, Jeff McVeigh, talking with the show's Lauren Gilger about their efforts to bring a new ASU campus to their downtown.
And the Arizona Board of Regents could approve the agreement to allow the plan to go forward today. So a lot more to come on this.
Thanks, Lauren.
My pleasure.
As we've been looking at this week, China is undertaking a rapid transformation into a world leader in scientific research. We heard about a massive program to cure blindness. Another area that the country is investing heavily in is marine technology. Only a handful of people have ever been to the deepest parts of the ocean, but China has plans to dominate the deep. The BBC's Rebecca Morel has been digging in.
I've come to a shipyard a few hours south of Shanghai, and a huge ceremony is underway. There are balloons flying, there's music playing, dragons dancing. And this is all for the maiden voyage of a giant research ship, which is about to go into the water for the very first time. With its tethers cut, the 100-meter-long vessel rolls into the sea. Built in a year, with its onboard labs equipped with the latest scientific kit, it will eventually explore the world's oceans. But it's also going to help China plunge beneath the waves. It's been designed as a launch pad for submarines that can go anywhere, no matter how deep.
Yeah. The shape is very streamlined.
That's right.
Important because you want it to travel quickly. How long to go to the bottom of the sea?
Yeah, less than 2 hours.
At Shanghai Ocean University, Professor Cui Wei Chung shows me around a full-scale model of a submarine that will eventually launch from this mothership.
Most important part is this part, the cameras, videos.
It's about 10 meters long, bright red, and inside there's room for a crew of three. Professor Cui has set up a company called Rainbow Fish, and its goal is to take humans to the deepest part of the ocean. The Mariana Trench, which lies nearly 11,000 meters down in the Pacific.
Up to now, human beings know much less about the deep oceans than we know about the surface of the moons and Mars. That is why we want to develop submersibles to reach the deep seas.
The very bottom of the sea is a place only a handful of people have experienced firsthand.
The deepest dive ever made by man. Jacques Picard and Lieutenant Walsh went down 7 miles into the Marianas Trench.
The very first expedition there was in 1960, when U.S. Navy man Don Walsh and Swiss explorer Jacques Picard made the record-breaking dive.
Steady, guys, steady, steady.
They were followed decades later by Hollywood director James Cameron, who took the plunge alone in 2012 in a bright green submarine. Rainbow Fish wants to be next, carrying out a dive in 2019. But China's government has also set its sights on the deep. Its manned Jiaolong submersible has carried out more than 100 dives, reaching an impressive 7 kilometers down. Now the government is planning a new vessel that can go even deeper. Its purpose, they stress, is scientific. But while China is involved in territorial disputes in places like the South China Sea, some fear marine technology could tighten China's control on the ocean. But the Rainbow Fish team says its venture isn't about politics. Wu Xing is the company's managing director.
Although the whole research is done inside China, but we consider this is a very much international cooperation. We get American scientists, the Russian scientists, the European scientists, all be part of the team.
For now, the deepest depths remain a mysterious alien world. But China's underwater plans are progressing quickly, and it could be the nation that will open up this final frontier. Professor Cui again.
I would like to be the first Chinese people to reach the Mariana Trench. We create our personal history. That's making me excited. Okay.
That's the BBC's Rebecca Morrell.
We're so close to the weekend. Maybe you're planning on taking a road trip around the state to get out of the heat. But as you cross bridges along the highway, you probably don't think that someone might be under them.
The show's Annika Klein introduces us to some people who are familiar with the underside of bridges and the rooftops of skyscrapers. They're called rope access technicians, and they go to great heights to fix, clean, and maintain structures.
Mike Duran and Casey Gilmore are gearing up. They look like they're about to go rock climbing.
We have synthetic slings, we have wire slings.
And lots of carabiners. But today they're not going too far, only about 10 feet off the ground. This is a training day at Absalon USA headquarters in Deer Valley.
So knots engaged.
And Duran and Gilmore are hanging from the ceiling. This is where new technicians start, to get comfortable hanging and climbing on ropes.
And lower myself out, right?
Once they get the hang of it and a technician is certified, it's off to work. At 40 feet, 400 feet, and even higher. Duran was the first technician to go under the skywalk at the Grand Canyon, a glass bridge that extends over the edge. Visitors can walk on it to look down into the canyon. Duran was tasked with cleaning it.
I was so hyped up all day long until the moment of truth.
The moment when Duran was faced with the 4,000-foot distance between the skywalk and the bottom of the canyon. It was the highest he had ever worked.
I get to the edge, and it's like, whoop, everything goes quiet.
Then he steps over the edge.
Take a deep breath. You're there. Let's go to work.
Duran's been doing rope access work for about 6 years now. And he says a lot of people aren't really familiar with it. The techs typically get called in as a last resort option.
They'll say, you know, we can't get in there with a crane, we can't get in there with a lift, we can't get in there with a stage, we can't get in there with scaffolding. We need you guys to get us there.
But Absalon CEO Ken Pipisar says it's becoming more well known. The company's next job is for the Arizona Department of Transportation to work on some bridges without closing the freeway. Pipisar says it's a change from what this type of work used to look like.
They use snooper trucks to reach under the bridge and do their inspections, but with us, we can rig it up very quickly and safely, access the area, do our work, and get out without anyone knowing.
The number of technicians is climbing, according to the Society of Professional Rope Access Technicians, or SPRAT. That's one of the organizations that certifies technicians, including those at Absalon. 10 years ago, just under 200 people got a SPRAT certification. Last year, more than 2,000 people did.
A lot of people are looking to enter this field as a career, so we've started doing training at our facility and offer SPRAT certification training for those that want to enter this type of industry.
That's allowed Absalon to do more jobs around the country, contracting the technicians they trained. They've hung above the Space Shuttle Atlantis in the Kennedy Space Center and been on top of multiple casinos on the Las Vegas Strip.
Well, we've changed the light bulbs at the top of the Eiffel Tower at Paris Hotel.
And how many rope access technicians does it take to change a light bulb in the Eiffel Tower?
Two.
One to change the bulb and one on standby for safety, of course. For the show, I'm Annika Klein.
And if you can handle the vertigo, I probably could not. There's a video of the technicians cleaning the skywalk at the Grand Canyon on our website, kjzz.org.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.